Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Dan Novak. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Cambodian students have designed a prototype drone that they hope can eventually be used to move people around Phnom Penh and even help fight fires. The drone was developed by students at the National Polytechnic Institute of Cambodia, a college in the capital city. The drone has 8 propellers and uses a school chair for the pilot's seat. Lon Van Sith, age 21, recently piloted the drone. The drone, when we see it flying without a pilot, there is a lot of shaking. But when I sit on it and fly, it becomes more stable, and I feel so excited, he said. Excited is a term that means very happy or enthusiastic about something. Van Sith added that the group of students wanted to solve some problems for our society by making a taxi drone and inventing drones for firefighters. He explained that the drone could reach the upper floors of a building to bring a hose if a fire truck could not reach the area. The prototype can carry a pilot weighing up to 60 kilograms and fly for about 10 minutes for a distance of 1 kilometer. It took 3 years of research and development, and it cost around $20,000 to build. The drone currently only rises as much as 4 meters, but the team hopes it will eventually fly far higher. The project faced delays because of coronavirus restrictions. Parts for the drone had to be purchased from abroad, said Saran Sarivatha. He is NPIC's head of research and development technology. The team plans to improve the design to permit it to take more weight and fly farther and higher. In principle, if we make one drone, the cost is expensive, but if we make them to sell on the market, the cost will go down, said Saran Sarivatha. I'm John Russell.
As a child, Claudine Humure lost both of her parents during Rwanda's genocide. She also had one of her legs removed because of cancer. Today, she is working to give back to her homeland. Humure spent part of her childhood in the northeastern American state of Massachusetts. There, she received cancer treatment and her first artificial leg. The 29-year-old recently returned to the state to get fitted with a new leg, also called a prosthesis. At Next Step Bionics and Prosthetics outside of Boston, she practiced walking on her new leg. It feels easier to walk on, Humure said. I don't know if it's natural. It's been so long, I don't remember what natural feels like. The artificial leg she had the last 4 years had been damaged by Rwanda's hilly land. The knee joint no longer moved smoothly. Humure's new prosthetic leg was given to her for free by Next Step. The device offers her the latest in artificial leg technology, said Arthur Graham. He has worked with Humure for several years. He watched closely as she used her new limb. Her new knee can quickly react as Humure moves her body weight from one side to the other, Graham said. The device's foot is also adjustable, so she can easily go from sports shoes to high heels and other kinds of shoes. There are not many places in Rwanda that have such technology, so Graham has provided Humure with advice on how to care for her prosthetic leg on her own over the years. Humure said her experiences led her to work toward a career in prosthetics. She will soon start a graduate program at the University of Washington in Seattle. She hopes to one day open a nonprofit clinic and provide less costly prosthetics to other Rwandans. The 1994 Rwandan genocide left a large number of people with severe injuries, Humure said. Yet many amputees there are still having to use incorrectly fitting devices or self-made systems because of the high cost of good prosthetic devices, Humure said. When Humure first came to Boston, she was 12 years old. She was using a wheelchair and had been living in a home for children without parents. She already had most of her right leg removed to treat bone cancer, but she needed additional treatments as the cancer spread. An international healthcare organization called Partners in Health worked to bring Humure from Rwanda to Massachusetts General Hospital for cancer treatments. Doctors at the Boston-based hospital also fixed the remaining part of her amputated leg so that a prosthetic could fit it better. A Boston couple soon became Humure's legal guardians. She returned to the city to attend high school. Later, she attended Wheaton College south of Boston. She completed her studies in biology in 2017. While in college, Humure worked with experts at Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Media Lab. She helped with the lab's research on the newest kinds of prosthetics. She also spent time working with recent amputees at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. Some of the people she worked with included survivors of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. Most recently, Humure has been living in Kigali, Rwanda's capital. She works at the University of Global Health Equity.
Schools in the United States are welcoming back students to classrooms this autumn. But they are facing a new problem: a shortage of teachers and school workers. Districts have faced shortages before, but many now say it is the worst it has ever been. The country's public schools have struggled for years with teacher shortages, especially in math, science, special education, and languages. But the COVID-19 crisis has worsened the problem. The pandemic has led to an increase in retirements and resignations. Districts across the country are reporting teacher shortages. In South Dakota, one district started the school year with 120 unfilled teacher positions. Across Texas, the main districts in the cities of Houston and Waco reported hundreds of teacher openings at the start of the year. Many schools across the country have had to close classrooms because of a lack of teachers. In Michigan, East Point Community Schools moved its middle school back to online learning last week because it does not have enough teachers. The small district north of Detroit has 43 positions open, one quarter of its teachers. When several middle school teachers resigned last week, the district started teaching online classes to avoid sending in inexperienced substitute teachers, said spokeswoman Caitlin Keenitz. This is obviously not ideal, but we're able to make sure they're getting each subject area from a teacher certified to teach it, Keenitz said. The National Education Association surveyed 2,690 educators in June. 32% said the pandemic drove them to leave teaching earlier than expected. Another survey by the Rand Corporation found that teachers had high levels of stress and were three times more likely than adults in other professions to experience depression. A school district in California's West Contra Costa County is considering hiring out-of-state math educators to teach online while a substitute teacher watches students in person. This is the worst shortage of labor we have ever had, said Assistant Superintendent Tony Wold. We opened this year with 50 teaching positions open. That means students are going to 50 classrooms that do not have a permanent teacher. There are 100 more openings for aides who help teach English learners and special needs students. There is also a shortage of cleaners, food services workers, and others, Wold said. Money is not the main problem. School districts have the money to employ more teachers and workers, thanks to billions of dollars in federal and state pandemic relief assistance. There are just not enough people looking for work. Mike Gelber is the assistant superintendent at the Morongo Unified School District in Southern California. We're all competing for a shrinking piece of the pie. I don't know if everybody is getting snatched up, or if they don't want to teach during COVID, he said. The Morongo School District of 8,000 students has put job advertisements in newspapers, radio, and social media. Teachers have also put now hiring messages into their students' lunch containers. The messages include a list of openings. Class sizes are also getting bigger. Mount Diablo Unified School District serves 28,000 students near San Francisco, California. It has had to fill several elementary school classrooms at 32 students, the most students there can be. At first, about 150 children signed up for online learning. But with COVID-19 infections rising, the number increased to 600 by the time school began. The same happened in Fresno, where enrollment in online learning went from 450 to 3,800 by the time school started. Of the 12 officials interviewed by the Associated Press in California districts, only one said it was not facing shortages. Long Beach Unified, the state's fourth-largest district, was prepared for the worker shortage. Last spring, it worked hard to hire 400 more teachers. We probably would have experienced the same shortages as others, said Long Beach Assistant Superintendent David Zaid. But we became much more assertive, and as a result, we are not in the same position. I'm Dan Novak.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation,
I'm Steve Ember in Washington. James K. Polk moved into the White House after his swearing in as the nation's 11th president on March 4, 1845. Polk told voters during the election campaign he would serve only one term as president. During those 4 years, he wanted to achieve or reach four main goals. Two of his goals related to money. Polk wanted to reduce taxes on imports and to establish an independent treasury. His other goals related to expanding the country to the Pacific Ocean. President Polk wanted to secure the Oregon Territory and California for the United States. Those who supported the president shared Polk's belief that the United States should extend from sea to sea, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. They felt it was God's will and their duty to spread American democracy and freedom across the continent. In the words of poet Walt Whitman, "It is for the interest of mankind that America's power and territory should be extended. The farther, the better." One way Americans wanted to extend the country was by making the Oregon Territory part of the United States. The territory included what are now the U.S. states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, as well as part of the Canadian province of British Columbia. American traders established claims to the Oregon Territory early in the country's history. But British explorers gave Britain claims to the same territory. The two countries could not agree on how to divide Oregon between them. Since few white settlers lived in Oregon, Britain and the United States agreed to occupy the area jointly. This joint occupation worked well until the 1840s. Then, thousands of Americans began moving west to Oregon. The new settlers wanted all of Oregon to belong to the United States. President Polk agreed. He thought the United States had strong claims to the entire territory. But he said he would compromise. He offered to divide Oregon at the 49th parallel of latitude. Everything north of this line would belong to Britain. Everything south of it, including the Columbia River, would belong to the United States. Britain's minister in Washington rejected the offer. He said Britain would accept nothing but the Columbia River as the southern border of British Oregon. President Polk said America had no choice then but to claim all of Oregon. He seemed to say the United States would fight, if necessary, to defend its claim. Polk did not really want war, but he thought he needed a strong position to negotiate with Britain. In London, the British government decided Oregon was not worth a war with the United States. After all, Britain had moved its trading center on the Columbia River north to Vancouver Island, so there was no real reason to demand rights to the use of the river. The British foreign minister proposed a treaty that would divide the territory at the 49th parallel of latitude. The proposal was almost the same that President Polk had made earlier. The United States accepted the proposal. The treaty made the 49th parallel the U.S. border from the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Ocean. South of this was California. An American government minister once described California as the richest, the most beautiful, and the healthiest country in the world. The official said the port of San Francisco was big enough to hold all the navies of the world. He said someday San Francisco would control the trade of all the Pacific Ocean. There was only one problem.
It was owned by Mexico.
Historian Robert Mary wrote a book about James K. Polk. Mr. Mary says Polk wanted to bring California into the Union anyway.
So obviously he had some underlying ideas about how that might be done.
At first, the United States attempted to buy California from the Mexican government. But Mexican officials refused even to talk about selling California to the United States. When the U.S. Congress approved statehood for Texas in early 1845, Mexico broke relations with the United States altogether. President Polk ordered the commander of the U.S. Army in Texas, Zachary Taylor, to move his forces into the disputed area near the Rio Grande River. The river formed part of the border between Texas and Mexico. Polk sent a representative to Mexico in an effort to reestablish diplomatic relations. But the Mexican government refused to talk with the diplomat. General Taylor sent one of his officers across the Rio Grande to meet with Mexican officials. The Mexicans protested. They said the area across the river was Mexican territory. The movement of American troops there, they said, was an act of war. For almost a month, the Americans and the Mexicans kept their positions. Then, on April 25, 1846, General Taylor received word that a large Mexican force had crossed the border a few kilometers up the river. A small force of American soldiers went to investigate. They were attacked. All of the Americans were killed, wounded, or captured. General Taylor quickly sent a message to President Polk in Washington. It said war had begun. Taylor's message arrived at the White House on May 9th. A few days later, the president asked Congress to give him everything he needed to win the war and bring peace to the area. Some members of Congress did not want to declare war against Mexico. They believed the United States was responsible for the situation along the Rio Grande. They were outvoted. Later, Polk wrote, "We had not gone to war for conquest, but it was clear that in making peace, we would, if possible, get California and other parts of Mexico." Many Americans opposed what they called Mr. Polk's war. Whig Party members and anti-slavery abolitionists in northern states believed that slave owners and Southerners in Polk's administration had planned the war. They believed the South wanted to win Mexican territory for the purpose of spreading and strengthening slavery. The president was troubled by this opposition, but he did not think the war would last long. He thought the United States could quickly force Mexico to sell him the territory he wanted. So Polk secretly sent a representative to the former Mexican dictator, Antonio López de Santa Anna. Santa Anna was living in exile in Cuba. The representative said the United States wanted to buy California and some other Mexican territory. Santa Anna said he would agree to the sale if the United States would help him return to power. President Polk accepted the deal. He ordered the United States Navy to let the former dictator sail to the Mexican port of Veracruz. But once Santa Anna returned, he failed to honor his promises. He refused to end the war and sell California. Instead, Santa Anna organized an army to fight the United States. In 4 months, he built an army of 20,000 men. When General Taylor learned that Santa Anna was preparing to attack, he moved his forces to fight the Mexicans. Santa Anna sent a representative to meet with General Taylor. The representative said the Americans had 1 hour to surrender. Taylor's answer to Santa Anna was short. Tell him to go to hell. The battle between the United States and Santa Anna's army lasted 2 days. Losses were heavy on both sides. On the second night, the Mexican forces withdrew from the battlefield. Taylor had won. The victory strengthened Taylor's public image. He had already won the Battle of Monterrey, a major trading and transportation center in northeast Mexico. Other American forces also were victorious. General Winfield Scott captured the port of Veracruz and was ready to attack Mexico City. Commodore Robert Stockton invaded California and had raised the American flag over the territory. Stephen Kearny seized Santa Fe, the capital of New Mexico, without firing a shot. Still, the war was not over. President Polk's short war already had lasted for more than a year. Polk decided to send a special diplomatic representative to Mexico. He asked the diplomat to negotiate a peace treaty whenever Mexico wanted to stop fighting. A ceasefire was declared, but attempts to negotiate a peace treaty failed. Santa Anna used the time to prepare for more fighting. So General Scott ended the ceasefire. His men began their attack on Mexico City. The fighting lasted 1 week. Finally, the government of Mexico surrendered and Santa Anna left power. On February 2nd, 1848, the United States and Mexico signed a peace treaty. Mexico agreed to give up California and New Mexico, and Mexico would recognize the Rio Grande as the southern border of Texas. The war was officially over. But historian Robert Mary says President Polk suffered because of the conflict. The war with Mexico, Mary says,
ended up being a much longer war than he had anticipated and much more costly in terms of lives, in terms of money, and in terms of his political standing.
The war with Mexico also influenced the U.S. election in 1848. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.